This is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
Absolutely fantastic!
Hello and welcome to Box on Macquarie Radio NTS News Talk Sport, the show that is everything football. You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley, and after a massive week in the game, Mark Van Aken will be in the studio shortly with all the news of the week before an extended look at how the fan crisis played out with Sebastian Hassett from the Sydney Morning Herald, Dean Hennessy with his observations on the weekend's A-League, plus feature guests Ollie Roos, captain, and twice-capped Socceroo Jackson Irvine on the line from Scotland to talk about his club and international career, and star of the Matildas World Cup campaign, Kaya Simon with a behind-the-scenes look at how our women's team come down from the giddy heights of the World Cup, the cancelled tour of the USA, and of course their tricky path to Rio 2016. Rob Tanner from the Leicester Mercury is going to give us an insight into the giant-killing Premier League Leicester City, and of course Ben Soro Perez will talk everything else that is Europe respectively, and Mark Van Aken will wrap it up with stoppage time. Edge, just a quiet week in the World game.
Well, my head hurts because it's just been a massive week on social media. The fans have taken control. They absolutely have dominated the airwaves all week. So much discussion, so much talk back radio, so many articles in the newspaper. Is this going to end? Well, the weekend, there'll be more of it. There's going to be fans not turning up to games. But let's get the latest from Mark Van Aken.
G'day, gentlemen. Just a quiet week in football, as you said there, Rob, off the top.
It absolutely was, mate. There's just nothing going on.
Nothing to see here.
In the Fed Income Department. Exactly. But it just keeps on rolling. Every time you think it's over, another Hydra's head bobs up.
Yeah, look, I know you guys are going to cover this off with Sebastian Hassett from the Sydney Morning Herald in a more broad, overarching context. But I think let's just go back to yesterday when we, of course, had the second FFA press conference of the week. Let's hear some audio from David Gallop.
Do you regret not coming out and speaking publicly about this article when it was first published last Sunday?
Yeah, we got that wrong. We should have said more earlier. Obviously, we had given responses to the article and we were also disappointed that not more of our responses appeared in the article. It was an article that unfairly tarnished the vast majority of decent football people. It actually tarnished FFA by saying that we were in denial and the numbers didn't actually match that. So we should have said more earlier, no doubt about that. We got that wrong.
You sure did, David. You sure did. Look, the only tick I'll give David Gallop yesterday was he finally admitted he was wrong and he'd botched this thing. Not in those words, but he admitted he was wrong. But from go to woe, this thing has been so poorly handled. And the fact that they've come out on Wednesday, was it Wednesday or Tuesday? Tuesday or Wednesday? Yeah, it was Tuesday. Then again on Thursday yesterday to do this whole thing again. And really, I've got to say, the way this presser went, guys, For the first 5 or so minutes, you thought, oh, no, he's actually making it even worse. And eventually the worm turned. At least we got to hear from Stephen Lowy for the first time, the invisible man of Australian football. Let's hear what he had to say.
I listened carefully to what David said on Tuesday, and I must say that I was amazed to see the interpretation that some of you have put on his words. He made it clear that the troublemakers are a tiny minority. He praised the overwhelming number of fans who make our game great. He said we would look at ways of improving the banning system. Somehow that got interpreted as FFA not sticking up enough for the fans. Nothing could be further from reality.
Stephen Lowy, you're a much smarter man than me. You're worth probably about $2 billion worth more than me. But how you were amazed that what David dished up, the CEO of the FFA on Wednesday, was misinterpreted. Wow.
Yeah, that's just amazing.
It wasn't misinterpreted because it was interpreted exactly as it was by every single last football media outlet and many, many non-football media outlets in this country.
And it seemed that Stephen was trying to say that he and David were the only ones marching in step. It was almost embarrassing to hear that start. And as you said, they sounded like they were making it worse until they just gradually grasped it back from the jaws.
Well, how do you reckon, this is the first time we've seen Lowy Jr., Michael. How did you see it?
Well, I heard during the week that Gallup thought the issue wasn't a chairman's issue, and that was probably a bum steer for the chairman. He needed to really be all over this from the word go, and he needed to really send a message to the fans that was had more conviction than what he did yesterday. There's no question about that. So I would give him a 5 out of 10, and I'd give Gallup about a 3 out of 10. The game stakeholders need more. It was very clear leading up to the press conference. Tony Pignata's open letter, leading up to the press conference, DiPietro's speech at the Victory and Business Lunch, the stakeholders of the game needed more.
Look, we can't do this justice in this segment. So luckily, we've got Sebastian Hassett, one of the foremost football writers in Australia, coming up. So you guys can continue the discussion. The only other, I guess, bit of news yesterday morning, massive news, Liverpool smashing Southampton 6-1 in the League Cup. But the best part of that was one of the goals in the second half from Aussie Brad Smith and Ollie Roux. Of course, we'll be talking to Jackson Irvine, his Ollie Roux comrade, a little later. But he put in an awesome cross for the goal.
Brad Smith. Oh, super ball. And Origi's got a hat-trick. Ten Liverpool appearances at the start of his career without a goal. And he'll be taking the match ball home tonight. Brad Smith, recently introduced off the bench.
Great news. Brad Smith, of course, only just recently re-signed by Liverpool. And what I can report, guys, Jurgen Klopp, the reaction, obviously that was a hat-trick for the other player being mentioned there, but Jurgen Klopp did have this real look of amazement on his face, and I guess it's great for Brad to come into this team. And anyway, and look, we don't want it to be all negative news, but of course the flag, the box-to-box flag, is at half-mast, the corner flag, because, of course, the great man Joe Marsden did pass away, the absolute pioneer of Australian football.
Absolutely, and Preston North End have honoured him in just the way that he should have been. A total legend. So thanks, Mark. Next, coming up, Sydney Morning Herald, Sebastian Hassett, and we will drill deeper into the fan crisis that has engulfed the game.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
The Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
On digital radio, streaming on the NTS app. You can also search for NTS on TuneIn Radio. And it's great to have one of Australia's most respected football writers, Sebastian Hassett, on the line to analyse just how this fan crisis got out of hand and where we're at now. Good to have you back on the show, Seb.
Yeah, great to be back, gentlemen.
Seb, Rebecca Wilson kicked this off, but I actually thought the whole fan crisis grew a leg when Mark Bosnich took on Damien Dubowen, and we've got a grab, so we're going to throw to that grab right now, and then we'll get your comments.
Damien, thanks for coming on the show. When are you going to install a proper appeals process, not for fans to come to you with evidence as to why they should not be banned, when you actually say to them, this is the reason why you're being banned? And the second question is, when are you going to stand up for the fans, not only you, but everybody at the FFA?
Mark, we love the fans, make no mistake about that, and I think there's been some commentary about whether we've been silent this week. The reality is this is a complex issue, one that we're working through, and we've been doing a lot of work in the background, including meeting with some of the active fan groups this week, and that offer is there for all the clubs and all the fans for us to meet with them and continue to work on that. From our perspective, in terms of having a process that fans can partake in, the reality is that we go through a very careful process with banning. We're talking about some really serious situations. It's based clearly on evidence. And what we're producing
Damien, sorry to interrupt you. We're not talking about the people who have done serious things. They won't appeal. They are in the wrong. No one's defending them. We're talking about people who are innocent, right, and have got no right to appeal. Can't you see with the thousands walking out that this has gone beyond serious? 2 years ago, we're at the Albion, you and I, when this first started with the Wanderers supporters, and we heard it then, and it's gone on and on and on and on.
So the time for
I'm saying to you, Damien, the time for empty rhetoric has stopped. You've got to do something, or you're going to lose fans continually.
Seb, that was that really, for me, it just the whole issue grew a leg out of that interview, and in social media things took off. And then yesterday it culminated with the new FFA chairman Stephen Lowy being effectively blooded into this national media over this issue. So I just would like to get your thoughts on how the week's transpired, and probably importantly, how do you think our new chairman went, and what's the outcome for David Gallup and all this?
Just an extraordinary week. In a sense, it could only happen in football, couldn't it? And particularly Australian football on the A-League, given we've gone through so much over the years. But this was a really unique set of circumstances. Some of them ignited, obviously, by the article by Rebecca Wilson nearly a fortnight ago now. It's hard to believe because so much has happened in that time. But I think a lot of other issues have now boiled to the fore, and really all the airs and grievances of fans are now coming out, and some of them have been long held, some of them are new, but they're all coming out now. All the cards are on the table. And the fact that we've reached a point now where we've already had a walkout or a couple of walkouts last weekend, and now we're going into the stage where we're having entire boycotts of active fans. This issue is just incredible. The FFA's response, look, it hasn't been one of their finest hours in terms of PR. Certainly they took forever to address the story as it bubbled along last week. Now, you could possibly argue that David Gallop was abroad, and I think Damien Bowen was also away until the weekend, until he had those comments with Mark Bosnich. But they just took so long to address the issue. And when they did, certainly when David Gallop did on Tuesday, it was quite a limp response. And I think a lot of the fans felt this is proof that we are truly isolated here. We are on our own, and our governing body doesn't care about us, which led us, again, going back to the FFA today, 48 hours later, and they clarified that. And the question about Stephen Lowy is certainly an interesting one, because that is a baptism of fire if ever I've heard one. And he's really finding out about the cut and thrust of Australian football politics right from the get-go. And look, I thought he actually handled himself quite well. I thought his comments were good. I mean, he is certainly new in the job, but he did clarify that, you know, the FFA is with the fans, and they do want to try and enact an appeals process that is more fair. But boy, there's certainly a lot to do to clean up this mess, Jen.
He certainly found his voice. He was actually interjecting a couple of times in the press conference, wasn't he?
He was. So, I mean, look, although he's new to the role, I mean, I suppose he has been around the game, hasn't he, for so long. A, through his father, and B, as he mentioned in the press conference, he's been a fan and contributor to the game for 40 years. So I think, to an extent, he certainly does get it, which is almost the universal phrase when you talk to active fans. They always say the same thing. You know, what we do is very different, and the FFA just don't get it. But hopefully, what Stephen Lowy will bring to the table, I think, is a little bit of understanding, perhaps a bit more than his father ever would have, in terms of placating these fans, because they are such important stakeholders in the game.
We're talking to Sebastian Hassett from the Sydney Morning Herald on NTS News Talk Sport. This is Box to Box. Now, Sebastian, when you strip away all of the layers that this story has gradually unpeeled, you get back to the very point, which is that ultimately no football person, any person who's had a say in this whole matter from a football angle, disagrees with the fact that some of the people on the list of 198 should not be allowed inside a football stadium again. My great concern in all of this is that that small group of people, those troublemakers, and I've been to hundreds of A-League matches since the first match all those years ago. There was only one game that I felt there was concern for my safety, where I had my older son there. It was the semi-final last year between Victory and City, where the coins were thrown and the seats were ripped up and all sorts of things. That was the only occasion that I felt that it really got out of hand in my presence. But I feel that small group of people are masking themselves under the umbrella of the greater argument, and that they might be almost getting away with their contribution to the whole story that got out of hand.
I think the critical distinction we need to make is the difference between football fans and criminals. I mean, these guys who are committing acts that are illegal, certainly those on a regular basis, I mean, and the FFA claims to have the intelligence to be able to identify those who are the perpetrators who are you know, doing the wrong thing. I mean, we need to make a really clear distinction here. I think that those of us who have been around the game for long enough and we've stood on terraces and whatnot, there is an issue certainly in the way police identify certain fans and whether they always get it right, which has led a lot of people, I think, in this banning and appeals process to feel that they've been wronged. Look, I'm not certain that the FFA has a bulletproof way of dealing with this. They, in a in a briefing today that with some senior journalists, the FFA outlined how they go about the process of getting that information and how they come to the conclusion that these are the fans they're going to target. But I must say, I wasn't necessarily 100% convinced, and I think there is going to be an ongoing problem, really, until I think the ultimate solution has to be, guys, is more self-policing. And those clubs, well, the active fans who are willing to self-police, as we've seen in the Cove with Sydney, and as we're starting to, or we have seen with the North Terrace in Melbourne, you know, they've had very, very few actual bans. This has sort of been overlooked. It's possibly, you know, it's certainly a way forward. There are solutions there, and I'm a huge believer in self-policing. When you put that responsibility on fans, they're pretty good at weeding out a lot of the trouble, mate.
Sebastian, but the issue sort of was broader than the 198 that were banned. That's been, you know, there's been a few interjections of you know, the broader soccer following, the broader soccer fans being, you know, tarred by people like, you know, comments that Andrew Scipione, the Commissioner of Police in New South Wales. But we found there was an interesting little bit of dialogue between Jared Waitley and Waleed Ali on Offsiders, which for me gives an indication of some of the underlying issues. Let's just listen to that and we'll get your comments.
I didn't understand the Friday night sign, "We stand by the 198. I wonder if the people who made that and held that fully appreciated the ramifications and the consequences of what they're saying.
I think what they think they're saying is not what you think they're saying.
I think they're foolish.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. But what I think they're trying to communicate is that we're all lumped in together in this.
Yeah, I don't think they are.
No, you may not. Yeah, but exactly. I think that's what... And if you look at the way the reaction to this occurred in some of the media, I mean, the Alan Jones comments are most famous, but there's a really horrible undertone to the way in which football fans are spoken about in this country. And I don't mean just the hardcore. You know, there's a dehumanized... They're spoken about as animals. That's serious stuff. And when you're on the receiving end of that, that's what gets you back up. And so that's why you end up going too far and aligning yourself with that portion you shouldn't be, because you fear, well, really, in the eyes of everybody else, there's no difference between us. So there's a kind of perverse solidarity that ends up creating, and I think that's what we've witnessed.
Sebastian, I thought Waleed's comments were very insightful and really summarised where football fans are feeling at the moment.
Oh, they're just so eloquently put across, weren't they? He's got a wonderful way with words. And you know, Jared Waitley, as we all know, is a pretty intelligent guy. But you know, he probably reflects what a lot of people outside football think, who, to use that phrase again, just don't quite get it in terms of the unique way that football fans support their clubs. We don't do it in a similar way to other codes. We are active. We're not passive. We don't sit on our seats. Some people, you know, we like to get up and stand and cheer and chant. That's what we do as fans. And it's that uniqueness that makes the game special. It really does. And look, those comments, it's really heartwarming to hear someone in the mainstream media like Waleed Ali is that actually does get it to that extent. And why, even though, yes, I think we all acknowledge probably a lot, if not most, of that 198 probably have done the wrong thing, there is a sense of solidarity there, because there is also a very much a concern that for a lot of fans out there thinking, well, that could have been me. You know, I might have accidentally said a swear word, right? I might have accidentally done something wrong or been in the wrong place at the wrong time. And boom, you know, that's 5-10 year bans, whatever it might be. There's a lot of people, I think, who have that sense of solidarity that a lot of these guys have been wronged. And the fact that there's been no formal appeals process really has just amplified that.
Well, thanks, Seb. But this story's not going to go away. We're going to need to have you back on a few more times before it takes its natural course and hopefully does find its place in the history of the A-League and helps to bring people together so that we can all enjoy the game for what it is, the active fans can enjoy the game in their own style, that the general supporter can enjoy it, and then that group out there who are sports fans who don't go to A-League games, who need to be the next level of crowd support to build this competition to the equal in several years to come, I'd suggest, of the AFL and NRL. They're the ones we need to talk to, because at the moment, we're not only pushing away the traditional supporter, but we're giving no chance to the new supporter. So, Seb, thanks for coming onto the show again. We'll talk to you again real soon. And, mate, your insights are always valuable.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be on the show, and we'll get there. It's just going to take us a little bit of time.
Next up, Dean Hennessy with his roundup of this weekend's A-League action.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
This is Box to Box on NTS News Talk Sport on TuneIn Radio and on digital radio. Thanks to our very good mates at Chemist Warehouse. And we also welcome back our program regular, former Notts County man and 250-game veteran of the Victorian Premier League, Dean Hennessy, talking all things A-League. And last night, a good win for Melbourne City over the Central Coast Mariners.
Yeah, great win for Melbourne City. That's two in a row, scoring goals as well freely. So things are really looking up. I'm not sure Aaron Moyes had as bigger influence as he did the week before, because the week before was outstanding. And I know we talk about him a lot, but it seems onwards and upwards for Melbourne City.
And we welcome Dean for two segments, because Dean's going to join us with our Jackson Irvine interview shortly, because Dean actually spent some time in an academy with Jackson. He knows him well.
He made Jackson Irvine, didn't I? I heard him. Oh, that wasn't you that mentioned
no,
it.
No. But I'd like to think I had a little bit of influence on him.
Sure you did. Dino, let's just rattle through the games, but we really do want to focus in on the big one in a moment, Western Sydney and Brisbane Roar. But first of all, tonight, Sydney FC and Newcastle Jets. We spoke to Scott Miller on the show last week. He can, another reasonable result for Newcastle last week. So this is a bit of a danger game for Sydney.
Yeah, both teams coming back from draws from last week. You know, Sydney drawing with Wellington, and obviously the Jets also draw in with Brisbane, and again, playing against the Brisbane side, it's a good result and another valuable point. But I think just looking at the table, with Melbourne City's win and also, with victory, which we'll come to shortly, and the Western Wanderers and Brisbane playing each other, I think it's important that one of these team wins. So, and I think they'll be both determined to. I fancy Sydney. I think it's about time they bounce back and really took the game to the Jets, especially at home. So I'm going to back the Sydney boys.
Okay, and tomorrow afternoon, the Wellington Phoenix at home to Melbourne Victory. It seems almost impossible that Melbourne could lose after the form they've been in recent times, but Phoenix just keep on clawing back into games. There's something about Ernie Merrick's and the way he's coaching that side that's showing you some confidence, some resilience that the team has, that they just won't give up. And on 11 points, it doesn't seem out of the question that they could upset the Victory on their home.
No, look, Wellington, look, Ernie's very experienced. We've discussed this before in previous shows. Melbourne Victory are in a great vein of form, and obviously they're going to be coming in confident. They've been on a winning streak, the top of the table, albeit, just on goal difference prior to, obviously, all the games being played this week. But it is a slippery one, Wellington, but I still fancy Victory. They're playing some really, really good form, and also Berisha signing for two more years, which is great news for the club. So I'm going to back Victory to win away.
Okay, Daniel, let's roll up the sleeves. Let's have a really close look at Western Sydney Wanderers and Brisbane Roar, second and third. Brisbane, two out of the last six, so not so good after a great start, but the Wanderers, they're on a roll, five in a row.
Well, they have. They've won, as you just mentioned there, Reg. Brisbane got off to a good start, but then it started to stutter just a little bit, two wins out of the six. But Western Wanderers, on the flip side of that, obviously started pretty slowly, but then have just gone on this run. And, five games in a row at any level in any league is a great run. I think what we look at is there's so many comparisons to both these teams that are very, very similar. When you look at that, both teams like to pass, they like to keep possession. They've got in, like, Brisbane themselves as a team, I've got the most of the passes, so they keep a lot of possession. Boy Koronis, they've also got Broishy and also Mackay, so those three are always dominant in that midfield. On the flip side, Western Wanderers have got a lot of possession when they get the ball. And I think it's going to be a real key when we dig a bit deeper into this game on tactically how both of these teams try to approach this game.
Now, look, it'll be ignoring the elephant in the room if you didn't suggest that the week in the news off the pitch is going to have an impact on this. The Western Sydney Wanderers, the red and black block, what if they walk out during the middle of the game? I mean, I know it seems outrageous, but players are noticing these things. They're involved in all of this. It does have an impact in the game on the park.
Oh, look, it does. It's massive. I mean, the one thing that the Western Wanderers have brought to the table is that atmosphere. You know, there's nothing like it. It is like what it is in Europe and all around the world, with fanatical fans making a lot of noise. And it does help the players. You know, I'm convinced that when you can't hear each other and you're actually working on all the things that you train, when they go to a silence and it's a real quiet atmosphere, it just takes a lot out of the game. And I think if, for instance, they didn't show up or they did walk out, then I think the advantage then swings back to Brisbane. And as much as this cause is so, so big, I think trying to win six in a row, most probably going close to being top by the end of that week, six in a row, I think they've got to think really serious about that, because I think it can affect the game.
Okay, Dino, you're John Aloisi. You're heading down in a plane ride to Sydney. You're going out to Parramatta. There's likely to be a different atmosphere than previously. Put that to a side. How are you going to approach the game, Dean?
Well, I think John's come out in the press in recent weeks, you know, and also been very, I suppose, positive in the way that his team plays football, and he's been a little bit anti-football with some of the other teams that he's played against. So I can't see John changing too much based on the way I think he'll just attack the game. I think what they'll try and do is they'll keep the ball, they'll move it around, and they've obviously got a lot of firepower up front with McLaren and Borrello. And, you know, with Corona, Broishey and Mackay in possession, I think what they'll do in lots of ways is they'll keep possession, they'll overload the wide areas, which what in turn will happen then is it will give them more space to work in. Because by overloading the wide areas, although they don't cross a lot of balls in for goals, they've created nothing from wide areas in the sense of a cross and a finish. What it will do is that will now put a lot of pressure onto the Western Sydney Wanderers defence. And I think, depending on who scores first, it's going to be really important. You know, the stats are really stacked up with regards to, like, for instance, if Western Wanderers score first, they've won four games. Brisbane, when they've scored first, they've won four, drawn one, lost one. So sometimes the first goal is going to be really important, especially in this encounter. So I think John will go there and attack, and that's the best form of defence. And he'll rely on that, you know, he's got a pretty stable team. Most of the team have played nearly all the games all year. So I think he'll go and back himself to go and attack.
You're listening to Michael Edgley and Rob Gilbert on Box to Box News Talk Sport. We're with Dean Hennessy, football royalty. He's previewing the big match between Western Sydney Wanderers and Brisbane Roar. With Dean, you've just obviously talked about John Aloisi's approach. Now, let's talk to us about Tony Popovich's approach, because he needs to prepare defensively for what's going to be a full-on passing assault from the Brisbane team.
Look, I mean, I rate Tony Popovich really, really highly. And I know lots of talk when Ange got the job and he was like in the frame and most probably wasn't quite as experienced and maybe not achieved as much. But I think he's a really smart operator. I've known from inside sources of how much detail this man goes to. But he has, like he was a good defender himself, he'll set his defence up. And I think what he'll do is he'll allow them to have the space. He will actually try and get Brisbane to come towards them, basically drop off a little bit deeper than maybe normal, which what in fact then will happen is, as that happens and they win possession back, I think they'll go to a lot more of a counter-attacking. And you saw even weeks ago when Bridgie scored the winner very late in the game, it was from a counter-attack, when it just from a set piece at one end and then they've countered down the other. And I think this could work. And I think the space behind there with those front three, who are all contributing really week in, week out, they've won five in a row, they're confident. What you do when you defend as a group as well, what you actually get a little bit of that connectivity together as a group, where they're finding it hard to break you down, and then every time you go forward, they look exposed. But again, I still think it's going to come down to the first goal. The first goal could be crucial on how this all pan out.
Excellent analysis, Dean. So for our listeners, on Saturday night, look out for the passing game of Brisbane. Look out and see if Dean's right, if Tony Popovich plays his defence very deep and tries to catch them on the counter. Some more insight from
Dean. Yeah, I've just got one stat which is really, really interesting. And you know, we've done our research on this game. Brisbane score goals in the first 15 minutes, and they score in the first 15 minutes of the second half. So they come out of the blocks really quickly. So they will be aware of that, because half their goals, or just under, have come from early starts in both halves. Western Sydney Wanderers, absolute opposite. They go the other way. They've scored the majority of their goals in the last 15 minutes. So for me, again, depending on where it's poised, this game could go either way. And I think the crowd, you know, we go back to the first point that was made earlier. If the crowd are there backing this team, Western Sydney will win this.
Fantastic analysis, Dean. We know that you understand the depth and the nature of coaching and managing teams, and that's what we want to hear from you in future, and that's what we're going to do as we go forward. We're going to be breaking out one particular game each weekend and analysing it so that we can really dig deep and get some analysis from you as the coach. So there is one more game left for the round, which we aren't going to go into a hell of a lot of analysis about, the two teams holding up the foot of the ladder. It all looks over for them, Perth and Adelaide. How do you see that one playing out? Do either side have any hope at all?
Well, I think with my coaching hat on there, and I think, you know, we've all been in this place before, you know, as much as all the successful managers all around the world have had success, they've always had their dark days where they're in this position that both the Adelaide and Perth coach are in. And I think what it is now, it's where there's got to be a collective bargaining between the whole playing group and the coaching staff and the support staff, that they're one win away from turning it around. And if you look at the league table, Perth are on 4 points, Adelaide on 3. Really, if Perth kick, you know, say for instance, Perth go and win and get 3 points, all of a sudden now the gap goes from an Adelaide point of view, it's now out to 4 points, and that's a long, long way to go when you haven't been winning football matches, which they haven't done so far.
And Dino, expected temperature 40 degrees, a bit of a whisper that Adelaide's trying to push it back. What happened last couple of weeks ago with Graham Arnold's comments, watch this space, but cellar dwellers, not a lot of interest in this game. Other than the weather.
No, look, and I think that's still a really valid point. We know what Adelaide can be like in the heat. I've been there many a times, and I'm certainly not good in the heat. But I think, again, Adelaide have got to kickstart their season. And maybe, Perth are used to the heat as well, so I don't think there's a big advantage or disadvantage. But I still think, for me, I'm going to back Adelaide to actually going to turn something around and actually get on the board and hopefully start their season.
We'll find out next week just how accurate you are, my friend. Dean, great to talk to you again.
Thanks, Robin. Thanks, Edge.
NTS News Talk Sport. Up next, Jackson Irvine, Ollie Roo Captain.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Welcome back to Box to Box on NTS News Talk Sport, digital radio on the NTS app. You can listen to us on TuneIn Radio as well. And among the many young Australians plying their trade in the international game, one of the rising stars is Jackson Irvine. The 6'3", 22-year-old from Melbourne was on the books with Victory as a junior, but was signed by Celtic in 2010. After a frustrating period earning his stripes, including a loan spell with Kilmarnock, he signed a 2-year deal with Ross County, and this year it's all come together at club level. Captain of the Oli Roos as they work towards the Rio Olympics and twice capped Socceroo, welcome Jackson Irvine.
Hi guys, thanks for having me.
Not at all, mate. So I just want to read something from a recent article in the Scotsman. So as recently as October, under the headline "Why Celtic May Regret Giving Up on Jackson Irvine," among other things, in a very lengthy article praising you, Craig Fowler wrote, "His gallops up and down the park are a joy to watch. One of the best sights in the league at present. Mainly because when he charges forward with the ball, the spectator knows something good is going to come from it. That's because the most impressive part of his development has been with the football. His touch, passing and awareness in possession have improved tenfold. There's now a subtle element to his game to go along with the all-action style." High praise indeed, Jackson. It must be pretty satisfying to hear one of the locals write about you like that, mate.
Yeah, it was a really nice read, that one. You know, it's not often you get praise like that, but it's you know, it's nice to know that your good form is being recognised, and you know, especially as he touched on, I'm developing a different side to my game now, which probably hasn't been seen by a lot of people. So it's nice to be recognised for that.
Jackson, we've got Dean Hennessy with us, who is our regular A-League correspondent and talks all things A-League. But obviously, Dino was involved in an academy which you participated in when you were a young fella. Dean's been trying to take all the credit for your success.
Course.
So what can you tell us about those days? And then I'll let Dean get on the air and ask you a question.
No, those are great days. I remember them very clearly down at Box Hill. So we had some good times down there.
Jackson, it's Dean here. Hope you're well.
How you going, Dean?
I'm good. Thanks, mate. Obviously, I played against your dad, and that was in my very early parts when I was 17. How much advice and how much of a role model has your dad been in your career?
Yeah, my dad's been, obviously a massive influence on me over the years, and it's not been probably the way a lot of people might think. My parents, never put sort of any pressure on me, and never really never forced me sort of down this path or anything like that. They're always just, you know, supported every decision that I sort of made along the way, and you know, the opportunities that all came around never sort of led from them pushing me towards anything, and they've just always been so supportive and helped me along the way. But you know, I always look for the shake of the head or the nod of approval from my dad. I still do, even as I did when I was a kid.
Look, I know you're obviously when you were with us in the on the Onside Academy with the Derby County product that we had some really, really good players that have now gone on to bigger and better things, like yourself. Your Lee Broxham's obviously played youth international as well, and I think when they look back now, how much of an influence did that have on what your next move was? Did that give you a little bit of a taste to go overseas and explore what may lay ahead over there?
Well, I think to be honest, I think every sort of part of my youth sort of contributed to that. You know, I was fortunate enough to have come overseas on holiday times with my family over those years, and you know, I'd been to games. My cousins were both part of the youth set up in Scotland as well, so I'd been to see them play and things like that. So I think there was a lot of contributing factors into what sort of pushed me to go overseas. But in the end, it just turned out to be luck that got me over here. So, you know, it was, of course, that definitely played a part in, you know, wanting me to go overseas. But, yeah, I think there was a number of factors that all sort of pushed me to have a go in Europe.
Jackson, it's Rob here. Now, we've heard Dean talk about your dad, Steve, born in Aberdeen. Of course, your mum, Danielle, who's a great friend of ours at NTS News Talk Sport and our sister station 3AW, from your Dutch side of the family. So you've got a real international pedigree with your grandfather, who I've met. He's a great man as well. And they, as you say, they didn't in any stage push you, but they just encouraged you and gave you the opportunities. But those early years at Kilmarnock, at Celtic, of course, first... How deep did you have to dig to stick with it? That self-belief, I know I talked to your mum on many occasions. She just was so proud of your resilience and your determination to just never give up.
Well, yeah, it's one of those things, you know, it's never easy. I'm sure anybody that's moved away from home, not even for sporting reasons or anything, you know, is always going to find it difficult. You know, I was only young. I'd only just turned 17. When I made the move, and I was still in year 12, I was doing my VCE, I was training full time with Celtic, and then coming home and doing my VCE work as well for about 8-9 months, and then I had a setback with an ankle injury in my first year. I was out for about 4 months injured with that as well. So, you know, it wasn't easy. The first year and a half was probably the hardest, and obviously I was trying to deal with the FFA had stopped my international clearance coming through, so it was 10 months in the UK before I could even play competitive games. I was only allowed to play in friendlies and things like that. So, you know, frustrating period in my life that was. But, you know, again, it was something that, you know, I felt if I could get through that, then I could get through anything. And I think it probably only did make me just grow up that little bit faster and get a bit more used to my surroundings.
You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley on Box to Box on NTS News Talk Sport. Jackson, you're the Ollie-Roos captain. Let's just have a look forward. We obviously get the results and we get to read articles about how you're travelling, but we don't get a lot of vision, or we don't see the lead-up games a lot. The results have been mixed. So are you starting to feel the pressure? Obviously, next January in Dubai is the three games that mean so much, but how much are you obviously playing during the week with Ross County, but how much are you thinking about the importance of the Ollie Roos activities?
Yeah, you know, it's vitally important, and you know, again, of course, the players have been very disappointed with the results over the last two or three camps. You know, to be honest, it's not been good enough from our part. You know, we shouldn't be losing these games, especially we shouldn't be losing goals in the manner in which we have. So, you know, but it's all about learning, and, you know, I think even towards the last game, most recent game against Iran, we showed a massive improvement, and, you know, we're managing to cut down on sort of individual errors that have been costing us goals and things like that. So that's always a good sign. But, you know, Vidi, earlier Vidmar, has been really putting his points across to us. You know, we've got a clear picture of the way he wants us to play now. And, you know, it hasn't been easy with chopping and changing of squads, boys being included in the Socceroos, you know, which has broken up the squad, and then boys been in and out of injuries with their clubs as well. So it's been a bit of that continuity. sort of amongst the players, but you know, there's no excuses at the end of the day. And January comes, we've got three absolutely massive games. You know, we'll take that group as it comes, and then hopefully when we the knockout stages, you know, that'll get us through the Olympics. But it's not going to be easy, that's for sure. But you know, we're all fully focused at the moment to sort of get to Rio.
Three games in 6 days: UAE, Vietnam, and Jordan. What can you tell us about those countries?
You know, every country in Asia is improving at such a fast rate. You know, people think that you know, Australia should be cruising to tournaments and things like that, but it's getting harder and harder every year. And you know, we're seeing the improvement all the time in the games that we play against these countries. That you know, they're getting their own style. You know, they all set up, you know, in similar ways, which is first and foremost to stop you, to stop the, you know, us from playing the way we want to play. It's not easy. You know, again, I've said it before, it's not easy. And but you know, we have to deal with that. And you know, we had a tough campaign to qualify for the Under 20 World Cup, which we, you know, we managed to do. We played against Jordan in that tournament as well. So you know, we have a little bit of knowledge of what they'll be like. But you know, to be honest, the opposition is sort of second. You know, first and foremost, it's about what we do. We believe we have the players and the sort of tactics to sort of beat anybody. So it's all gonna be down to us.
And Jackson, a couple of quick things before we go. Ross County this weekend, you've got St Johnstone. Now, this looks like the last year before Rangers re-enter the top level of Scottish football. So the opportunity is there against St Johnstone to grab the 3 points. Of the last five starts, you've had two wins each and a draw. If you can get those points, then you start to nudge into that top level of potential top two finish. Celtic seem to be well out in terms of the top of the ladder and possible European football. Does the club look at opportunities like that just yet, or is it just, you know, one week at a time, as we hear in the local leagues?
Yeah, you know, one game at a time is always an easy thing to say, but at the end of the day, you've got to have ambitions. You know, you've got to have targets and goals for where you want to be come the end of the season. And you know, we had such a tough start to the last year, and you know, sitting bottom of the group. And then since then, you know, we've been in sort of outstanding form. You know, we've not going on, you know, sort of 12, 13 unbeaten streak at the end of last season, and we've carried that on. And you know, 16 games into the season, and we haven't been outside the top half yet. So you know, we're only looking forward, and you know, they're the informed team in the league right now. So it's going to be a really difficult game for us. But you know, we think that, you know, if we can pick up the 3 points this weekend, we're going into a really good run of fixtures for us, including a lot of games at home. You know, we're really strong at home, and you know, we feel that if we can get that run off to a good start come this weekend, then you know, we've got a real good chance of sort of breaking into that top four, first of all, and then taking it from there.
Well, good luck, mate, and we're all watching you very closely from this end. And finally, the one quick question I wanted to ask you. You've been capped twice with the Socceroos, first of all in 2013 against Canada, but the most recent time, the rumour suggests that you thought it was a bit of a G-up when you got a text message from a mate because you didn't recognise the number.
That actually sort of happened both times. The first time as well, when I received the text message, the same thing. You just sort of look at it like... Actually, the first time I got my call-up for the game against Canada, I didn't tell anyone for 2 days because I thought it was a joke. I didn't want to go out and tell anyone.
You would have put the number in your phone, Jackson.
Eventually got around...
Yeah, his name's Ange Postecoglou, mate.
I should probably say that. Yeah, I know. Probably, well, if it was directly from him, I think I would have known. But no, it was sort of a funny one. And then I eventually sort of got around to just... buy back a 50-50 one to make sure, just to make certain, and then I could obviously let everyone know. But you know, it was a great honour to be called up, and great surprise both times. You know, it's not something you're always expecting, but you know, now that I've been a part of it twice, it's, you know, it's become a bit more of a reality now, and something that I've been striving to get towards again.
Well, it's been wonderful to talk to you, Jackson. We're going to talk to you many times in future on Box to Box. We want you to be part of this show to tell your story, not only at the club level, but we want to talk more about the Olly Roos, and we fully expect you to break into that Socceroos senior side in the years to come and watch your career roll out as it goes. So, mate, great to have you on the show, Jackson.
Thanks, guys. Thanks for having me. I'll speak to you soon.
Good on you, mate. News is next on NTS News Talk Sport, Box to Box.
Now, this is Box to Box with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley.
Oh, what a goal!
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
Absolutely fantastic!
And this hour, Rob Tanner from the Leicester Mercury is going to give us an insider's look at how the Foxes have gone from near relegation to top of the ladder. Ben Soro Perez will be in with his weekly European wrap. And before we wrap it up in stoppage time, when Mark Van Aken trawls through football's underbelly. But first up, 24-year-old star of Australian football, Kaya Simon. In her second World Cup, she scored the goal 10 minutes from time against Brazil that propelled the Matildas to quarterfinals history and making their first knockout win, the first knockout win of any senior Australian team in a World Cup. Great to have you on the show, Kaya.
It's great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Not at all. And before we start to talk about your career at international level and club level, etc., how did it feel the moment that ball hit the back of the net?
Yeah, I think I can almost feel like it was yesterday, and it was such an extraordinary moment in my career, but also obviously for the Matildas in Australian football. And you know, to come on and see how hard the girls had fought for so long in that game, and you could just see the hunger in each of the girls' eyes and how badly we wanted it. So you know, to be able to kick that goal in the back of the net and be up 1-0 against Brazil in the round of 16 was definitely a memorable moment for me, and an honourable one as well, and just a proud moment to be a part of the Matildas and representing, you know, our beautiful country.
And Kaya, how long did it take before you realised throughout the course of that tournament that you'd really captured the attention, not just of the sporting and football public, but the Australian public in general? Because you certainly did.
Well, I think it was the enormity of kind of the, I guess, the media attention that we received after that result. You know, as a group, we were so proud of what we had achieved, but to know how proud the country was of us, and kind of, you know, we really grasped the attention of the world. You know, such an underdog of Australia to topple over, you know, a powerhouse like Brazil in any kind of football is a major achievement. And like you said, to be one of the first team to make it out of a knockout stage was an extraordinary achievement for us girls, and one that we'll never forget.
We followed the Matildas in the build-up to the World Cup. Your preparation leading into Canada was really probably the best the Matildas had ever had for any tournament. But you yourself, you were coming back from injury. During your preparation, Kaya, did you have any doubts that you were going to make it?
It was hard. It was probably the hardest point in my career that I've ever had to overcome. And it's hard. You know, watching the girls January last year in the Asian Cup for the qualifiers of the World Cup, I actually couldn't watch the games because I was so, you know, heartbroken that I should be there, and not being able to, you know, influence the game in any way and be able to perform and achieve what the girls did in qualifying us for this year's World Cup. It was really hard for me, and I definitely had to keep myself, you know, mentally in check and obviously tick the right boxes in terms of my rehab and my recovery. And it made it easy to have my sights on the World Cup and know that, you know, that's where my goal was, and that was to be at, you know, the World Cup in Canada this year. And I think that's what really drove me and, you know, made me as resilient as I was in that whole 15-month rehab period. But, you know, when you get the opportunity, like you do, to perform on the world stage, you know, in those big games, that's what makes it all worthwhile. All those hours of rehab, those extra training sessions, all the people that invested their time and effort and support into me, my close family and friends, to get me back, you know, really supported me. And to have my family in the crowd at the World Cup again this time around, it was really special to me.
We're talking to Kaya Simon, star striker with the Matildas, about her career and her time with the Matildas in the World Cup in Canada recently. Now, we're going to go back briefly because there's a lot to cover in your career. At the age of 15, you broke your leg just as you were on the verge of earning a scholarship with the New South Wales Institute of Sport. Talk about resilience. At that tender age, that must have really taught you a lot about how to get back on your feet again and go through rehab and out onto the pitch again.
Yeah, definitely. That was probably my first major test, I guess, in my career. But also, I guess, as a young lady as well, to be able to sustain a major injury and then have to, you know, really bounce back and still stay so engaged in the sport and so focused that, you know, I hadn't yet achieved you know, my goals, my major goals of representing the country and, you know, achieving big things and great things with the Matildas. So to be, I guess, faced with that challenge at such a young age, it really did, you know, pave the right track for me and really kept me, I guess, mentally in check. But you're going to have setbacks along the way. It's not always going to be smooth sailing. And, you know, I was grateful to then get the opportunity at the age of 16. A year later, Tom Samani brought me into the Matildas fold and I got my first opportunity to play with the team and to be, you know, within the squad in May 2008. So to get that opportunity at a young age and after obviously such a major setback was, you know, again, so rewarding that all that hard work really paid off.
Certainly has, Kaya. We've followed your journey so closely. You are a poster player for the Matildas. I want to go back to the World Cup in Canada. The artificial surfaces, there was a lot of talk by the Americans in the lead-up to the event. Now that it's been and gone, how did the artificial surface play for you, and is it just something that you deal with, or would you prefer to play on grass?
Yeah, it was obviously a very controversial topic leading into the World Cup, and ironically it was the American girls who play on, you know, turf week in, week out that made the biggest you know, fuss about it. But I think that the main point that they were trying to make was you would never see a men's World Cup on turf or on synthetic turf. They've always played on grass and always will play on grass. So to see, you know, a female code, you know, kind of take the short straw again was, you know, a little bit disheartening that it was almost a shortcut, obviously, easier to maintain for the World Cup. And that was disappointing, but I think at the end of the day, you just had to, you know, deal with the conditions, and it doesn't really, I guess, impact, you know, any team more than the other because everyone's on the same conditions. So, you know, it gave us time to prepare from January this year leading into the World Cup. It gave us time to prepare on synthetic turf and, you know, gave us time to get used to it as well. So as disappointing as it was, we all love playing on grass and, you know, that's how the game originally started and how it should be for every FIFA World Cup, men or women.
Well, you're going to be playing on grass in Japan in the upcoming in February and March of next year. I think it's 5 matches in 10 games, 6 teams vying for 2 spots to get to the Rio Olympics. It's a huge time. It's going to be a huge preparation, but what a task ahead of you, Kaya. What are you thinking about that right now?
Yeah, it's tough. I mean, you know, you struggle to play 2 games in 7 days, let alone, you know, 5 games in 10 days. So it's going to be a tough ask. And, you know, I have all confidence in the group of players that we've got, that we've got the talent. You know, the real test is going to be how we can back up, you know, games every second day, you know, with a squad of 20 girls, trying to back it up and make sure that we're as physically prepared as we possibly can. Because I have every confidence in the girls that we've got the talent. It's just a matter of being physically prepared and being in, you know, top shape going into the tournament. So we give ourselves the best chance to be in, you know, those top 2 spots leading into the Olympics in Rio.
And the confidence levels amongst the team, you probably a obvious question to ask a player, but how confident are the team, having done what you've done in the recent World Cup, that you'll get through?
Yeah, I think we can take some confidence from that, but in saying that, we know it's a tough challenge for us, and we're going to do all that we can in our power to give ourselves the best opportunity to qualify. And, you know, there's no greater feeling than qualifying for an Olympics, and I'm yet to do that. So I think, you know, the hunger amongst the group to be, you know, be able to say that we're Olympians when we get to Rio is really what's driving us. And, you know, it's one thing to go to a World Cup, but it's another thing to represent your country at an Olympics. And I think that's at the forefront of everyone's mind, and that's going to be what's driving us throughout these qualifiers.
Well, it's going to be a test of the squad, isn't it? Because obviously not everybody's going to be able to play 5 games in 10 days. We're going to unearth some new players in this process, aren't we?
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to take all 20 players. You know, the same 11 players aren't going to be able to back up every game, and it's definitely going to take you know, the depth in the squad to be able to perform every game. And there's going to be no easy games. We can never write off any of the five teams we're going to face, and it's going to be tough. So we need all hands on deck and everyone to really, you know, put in their all every game and every minute of every game.
And Kai, we can't let you go without first of all acknowledging you're the first ever Indigenous Australian, male or female, to score a goal in a World Cup tournament. That's got to be something that you're particularly proud of.
Yeah, definitely proud of my heritage, proud of my Aboriginal background, and it's something that I always take on with extra pride. You know, every time I represent Australia or wear the green and gold, that's always something in the back of my mind that, you know, hopefully I'm impacting some young Indigenous kids out there that, you know, they can really aspire to, you know, if they want to be a sports person one day, then hopefully I can, you know, influence them in a positive way, just like Cathy Freeman did to me as a 9-year-old girl. So, yeah, it's definitely something I'm proud of, and if I can continue to influence, you know, our younger generations to do great things among their communities, then, you know, that's really half my job done.
That's awesome, Kai. We can't let you go without sort of focusing on some of the off-field stuff. I'd love to know what your frequent flyer points balance is between playing for Boston Breakers, Sydney FC, the international team, all the preparation games, all the countries you've been to. But there was one moment. There was probably a low point in the Matildas' year after the highs of Canada. I was terribly excited to see the team head off to the US and play against the Americans, and probably for you guys to play in front of, I think they'd sold the stadium out for the matches. Obviously, you know, we know what was happening in terms of the pay deal and the CBA negotiations, but it must have been a great disappointment not to be able to go to America. It must have been a huge decision for you guys to take.
Yeah, it was. I mean, obviously America winning the World Cup and to get the shot at the World Champions in a couple of games would have been, you know, an enormous opportunity for us. And that was, you know, one of the major disappointments that it came from the whole pay dispute was it was an opportunity missed that we couldn't, you know, represent our country and play in such a huge game. You know, it's nice that we're now past that, and from our previous tour to South Korea just in the past week, it was the first time that we felt unified as a group again and really performed as we did in the World Cup, and that's a really nice fitting feeling, and we can really take confidence from the trip that you know, we're back to our old ways, and there's nothing that's going to stop us and nothing that's going to get on in our way leading into the qualifiers.
What is your frequent flyer points balance, Kaya? It must be huge.
I think they're up there. I haven't checked, actually. But between my Qantas frequent flyers and my velocity, I think they're somewhere near the top.
Good on you. You've deserved it.
You have done that, Kai. You really have deserved it. And it's been wonderful talking to you. We've only been on air for a few weeks in this program, Box to Box, but one thing we were determined from the very outset was to not only just acknowledge and recognise our wonderful Matildas, but to help to play our part in uplifting the role of women's sport in the game in Australia. So, Kai, this is the first chat we've had with one of our ladies, and you've done a brilliant job. We'll certainly have you on again. We could talk to you all night.
Thanks, guys. I really appreciate your support. Hopefully we can continue to move forward in the right way.
Sure will. Thanks, Kai. We'll talk again after the break. Rob Tanner from the Leicester Mercury.
Box to Box.
Can you believe it?
The Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Welcome back to Box to Box on digital radio, streaming on the NTS app. You can also search for NTS on TuneIn Radio. And after what looked likely to be a season in 2015-16 in the Championship, Leicester under Claudio Ranieri have resurrected their season and have stunned the football world with the good news story of the year. They share top spot on the Premier League ladder with Manchester City, and their star striker Jamie Vardy has set a new goal scoring record. To tell us all about it, welcome Rob Tanner from the Leicester Mercury.
Hi, guys.
Great to have you on the show, Rob. First of all, Leicester must be pumping. Tell us all about it.
Oh, the city is absolutely buzzing. This is beyond any of their wildest dreams. As you said there in your intro, you know, a year ago, we were looking at the possibility of relegation. It wasn't just a possibility, it looked like a certainty. They were rooted to the foot of the Premier League table, and there was, at one point, there were 7 points adrift of safety with games running out rapidly, but they embarked on a fantastic run at the end of the season, won 7 of the last 9 games to pull off the greatest of great escapes. because very few teams have been bottom at Christmas and managed to survive. There was a bit of uncertainty, obviously, in the close season when Mr. Nigel Pearson, who took them into the Premier League, then masterminded that great escape. He left the club for non-football reasons, and there was a bit of a mixed response to the appointment of Claudio Ranieri, who just come left his position as the manager of the Greek national team, having even lost to the Faroe Islands, which was, people thought was inconceivable. But he got the job, and it's been a fairy tale since then. And more so than the emergence of Jamie Vardy. I mean, his story alone is quite remarkable. I mean, I wonder whether how much Australian listeners will know about him. He gave up for 3 years when he was released as a youngster by Sheffield Wednesday, his hometown club. And he didn't play until he started playing Sunday League football for a mate, and then he got picked up by a non-league team that were very low down in the pyramid in England at Stocksbridge Park Steels, but then got spotted by Halifax, who took him on. He was still working in a factory making medical splints whilst playing for Halifax until he joined Fleetwood Town, and then he started scoring lots of goals at Fleetwood and caught the eye of a lot of clubs, but Dickie paid what is now still a record for a non-league player, £1 million to sign him. Now he has broken the record for scoring in the most consecutive league games in the Premier League, 11, breaking Ruud van Nistelrooy's record. It's a remarkable tale.
It is remarkable, but he's done it looking so cool. He's cool as a cucumber at the moment. I mean, did you ever in your wildest dreams think that he could do this?
I don't think even he thought he could do this, to be honest. Although it's a sign of his confidence that when he signed his Leicester City contract, and Leicester were in the Championship at the time, he had a clause written into his contract that he would get a bonus if he played for England. So he must have had confidence in himself. But to score in 11 consecutive Premier League games, you know, it's no mean feat. I mean, it's a very competitive division. Every defence is strong. You know, although they haven't played Man City away yet or Chelsea away yet, they're not in that run. You know, there's still some strong sides in there with some strong defences, and he looks like every time he gets a chance, he looks like he's going to put it away at the moment.
Your club and Jamie are playing fearless football, but isn't it amazing to think that on the weekend just gone that you felt probably a little hard done by, that you didn't get all 3 points?
Oh, absolutely, yes, because although United dominated possession, they never really opened City up at all, really. They only looked dangerous at set pieces, and City created the better chances, and they had the chances to win that game. And I think that, yeah, you're right, that is an indication of how far they've come and how much their fortunes have swung over the last 12 months, that they were coming away from the King Power Stadium thinking that's 2 points dropped rather than a point gained.
We're talking to Rob Tanner from the Leicester Mercury on NTS News Talk Sport. This is Box to Box about the amazing story that is Leicester City in the Premier League and, of course, Jamie Vardy. Now, the question on everybody's lips, people are talking about the ultimate slide. Will it happen? What will it take for it to happen? What will it take for it not to happen? Just how deep is the list that goes? We even see this weekend Matty James coming back and suggestions in your own paper today that Claudio Ranieri spoiled for choice. So is it inevitable that Leicester will slide off the top, or do you have hope that this dream run might continue?
Well, I think you've got to have hope that it can continue. I mean, this isn't a freak of nature that these run of results. This is over 23 games now, if you include the 9 at the end of last season. They've only lost twice, and both of those have been to Chelsea and Arsenal. So, you know, there is a consistency in their performance from the end of last season, despite the managerial disruption. So the people who are waiting for the bubble to burst somewhat, I mean, might have to wait a little bit longer.
Tell us about the fan reaction. Tell us about what it's like in the city leading up to games. Tell us about the atmosphere in the stadium. Is it all gone up a notch?
Oh, yeah. I mean, there is only one club in the whole of Leicestershire in the county, so everybody is pretty much a City fan. They might say they have allegiances to Liverpool or Man United or, you know, some of the bigger clubs when City aren't doing particularly well. But when City are flying, they soon get out of the blue. Obviously we've got the Leicester Tigers in the city as well, you know, one of the biggest rugby clubs in the country. But even Tigers fans are excited by what's happening down at City. And to illustrate how much the team are putting Leicester on the map, there was even a report in a German newspaper about City's exploits recently, and they had to put a graphic in with a pin in the middle saying where Leicester was, because nobody in Germany has ever heard of Leicester. And I actually remember speaking to a German journalist in the summer about Jurgen Klopp when he was linked with the Leicester vacant Leicester job, And he was saying to me, who is Leicester? Who are Leicester City? Why would Klopp go there? Nobody knows anything about them. But I think everybody knows about them now.
Well, what about Vardy for England? Tell us the fans and the media. Can he start?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, he's the informed striker, obviously, in the Premier League at the moment. They haven't got another game now till March when they continue their warm-up games for the European Championships. But if he keeps on this form, then he's got to be selected. He has to be. But the situation is in England is the perception that unless you're playing for one of the top clubs, a Man United or a Liverpool, you don't really get a look in if you're an unfashionable club like Leicester City. I mean, there are people like Danny Welbeck, Daniel Sturridge. You know, there are top clubs, and although they've got injury issues at the moment, you know, there's a perception that once they return with Harry Kane and Wayne Rooney, those will be the four that go to the Euros. But you've got to pick people on form. Unfortunately for Jamie, when he has had his chance at England level, he hasn't been played down the middle where he played for Leicester. Roy Hodgson's played him wide left, which isn't his suit at all. I mean, he thrives on the freedom to be able to run into channels, running behind defenders, get on the last shoulder, and he's a bit shackled when he plays wide left. So hopefully in the friendlies in March we'll see him play down the middle as the main man.
Will Roy Hodgson throw away a lifetime of conservatism though? He seems to be determined to stick with the players that have done it before. Wayne Rooney looked a little tired to me on the weekend, and Jamie Vardy fresh on his feet. Will there be an uprising amongst the fan, the media support, etc., and can Hodgson be strong enough to change his mind and shift and take the risk and roll the dice for a guy that's scoring goals for fun right now?
Yeah, I mean, I know that Hodgson is a fan of Vardy. When he was the manager of West Bromwich Albion, he was also watching him in terms of trying to sign him. So, yeah, you're right. He is seen as a conservative type of manager, and believe it or not, there are still elements of the British press as well that don't believe Vardy is good enough. They think this is a flash in the pan, but you know, they always got champion the likes of Rooney and Harry Kane. But you're right, Rooney is out of form at the moment. He looks like a man who's struggling, and you know, he's been playing as that focal point, that main guy down the middle. But I personally would love to see Vardy playing with Harry Kane. I think those two would be a fantastic partnership for England. I mean, you know, the one, Vardy, fast, quick, mobile, gets on the shoulder. And then you've got Harry Kane, who is a bit more of a link-up man. He could play with his back to goal and bring other people into the game, but also he's a clinical finisher. So that would be my partnership.
Our producer was telling us that I should ask you a question, that the only reason Leicester's doing so well, it's because Mark Schwartz has been in camp.
I'll tell you what, do not underestimate that guy's influence. He might not be playing, but he's got a wealth of experience, and that was one thing that last season City were lacking at the Premier League level, was experience within the camp, and that was the main reason that Nigel Pearson brought him in, because obviously he knew him from his time together at Middlesbrough. And, you know, it's not just what you do on the pitch, it's around the training ground, the way you conduct yourself. You know, it rubs off on the younger professionals, and Mark Schwartz is an exceptional professional.
Yeah, absolutely. And we've just been celebrating the 10-year anniversary of Australia's qualification for Germany 2006. And while John Aloisi takes all the glory for scoring the penalty against Uruguay, many forget that it was Mark Schwarzer that saved the two crucial penalties that allowed Aloisi to step up and take the glory. So if there ever was a pro who had ice cold water running through his veins, it's Mark Schwarzer. So if he does go out there for you, we're pretty confident, and as you seem to be clearly aware of, he's not going to let anyone down.
No, absolutely. He did play for a few games last season when Kasper Schmeichel broke his foot, and you know, he never let the team down. But as I said, he's just a genuinely nice guy, good, consummate professional, and he's a great influence in that dressing room.
Look, Rob, it's just been fantastic to talk to you. You know, we're loving this story for just so many reasons. Not only that most of us are sick and tired of the big four or five clubs in the Premier League winning every single year, and watching some of the other big names that are synonymous with football in England just, you know, going up and down and just trying to get to Europe. And what we all hope, and I imagine a lot of people in England hope, is that that this is a signpost for years to come, that that some of the other clubs will say, well, if Leicester can do it, so can we.
Well, there's a rock band in Leicester called Kasabian, and they have a big hit with a song called Underdog, and everybody loves an underdog, and Leicester City are that underdog.
Well done, Rob. Well, hopefully we'll talk to you again, and hopefully the story will just keep on rolling out, and we'll be talking about Europe and, look, who knows what in the new year. So good luck, and enjoy the ride as it continues.
Thanks, guys.
Next, Ben Soro Perez and his roundup of football in Europe.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
For Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
You're with Rob Gilbert and Michael Edgley on Box to Box on NTS News Talk Sport on digital radio, streaming on the NTS app. You can also search for NTS on TuneIn Radio. And now for his weekly insight into the English Premier League and Europe in general, former Brighton and Hove Albion insider Ben Soro Perez, and your old club continuing to do well at the top of the championship.
Yeah, they are. Yeah, I must admit, I may have been one of the doubters at the start of the season, but I think Tewton's doing a fine job. Long may it continue.
We talked to Rob Tanner from the Leicester Mercury. Perhaps your crowd could be the Leicester of the championship, and potentially.
It's a direction that the club's building in. Brand new stadium, brand new training facilities. Paul Barber coined the phrase Premier League ready, which they always speak about. So it's where they want to go. It's just, I think it's a case of when now.
Absolutely. Let's look at this weekend's Premier League, Ben, which is what you're here to talk about. Let's start with, obviously, Manchester City's trip to play the Potters. First game on Saturday.
Yeah, the early one at Saturday. I think you'd have to expect a City win here. They've scored 7 in the last 2 outings. Last time they played this fixture last year, I think they won 4-0. So history, form is on their side. Stoke are a mixed bag. Some weeks they look brilliant, other weeks... they really look as though they couldn't string a pass together, and I think last week's 2-0 loss to Sunderland proved that they're certainly prone to having these off days.
Normal kickoff time Saturday afternoon. Sunderland makes the trip to Arsenal. The Gunners, they've only won one of their last 5 games. You'd expect them to win this one, though.
You would, yeah. It's hard almost to pick a case for Sunderland winning or getting anything from this one, especially away to the Gunners, but... Well, as you said, 1 win in 5 is not the form of a team firing on all cylinders. Santi Cazorla could potentially be injured. They lost him in the week as well. So it's a hard one to pick. You'd fancy Arsenal, but Sam Allardyce is turning Sunderland into a resolute team. And we've seen Wenger struggle with physical sides before. So I wouldn't be surprised if a similar tactics employed by the Black Cats here.
And United versus West Ham, that ought to be a good game. West Ham are doing well. They're sitting mid-table and confident. United were not convincing at all in their stalemate against Leicester on the weekend.
Very much so. I don't know if stagnant's the right term, because they may well peak at some point under Van Gaal, but everything's flat around the club at the minute, and it's the complete opposite at West Ham. And they've only been outscored so far, I think, by City, Leicester and Everton. They've got 21 goals so far. They're firing well. I mean, they do still have a problem conceding, and I think Slaven Bilic's approach is partly to blame for that. You know, you wouldn't have seen this kind of openness when Allardyce was there. But I don't think it would be an upset if West Ham left with the points.
And the train wreck of the season, Aston Villa, they're on their way down to Southampton for another. Another messy game, I'm sure. I reckon they're going to get thrashed down there too.
You'd think so. Even before Southampton got absolutely annihilated in the week by Liverpool, the signs weren't good. Ronald Koeman's admitted he got his tactics wrong in that game. You'd expect him to write that. Southampton have quality in their ranks. They play good football. I don't know what you can say about Aston Villa that's even remotely positive.
And Rob Tanner... supremely confident at Leicester. Do you think they can bank those points against Swansea, who are just staying clear of the drop zone?
I think so. Gary Monk's side, for whatever reason, don't resemble teams or his team last season. Be that effort or, you know, quite where it is, no one seems to be able to put their finger on it. But Leicester are full of confidence.
We're on the wagon. We're on the Leicester bandwagon.
Yeah, I think a lot of people are. So we'll see what happens come January when, you know, there may be players circling for... you know, Leicester players, there may be some squad changes and all the rest of it, but I think at the minute you'd back Leicester there pretty comfortably.
And an important game for two clubs that are looking to stay up in the Premiership this year, Watford and Norwich.
Yeah, they're only separated, I think 5 points is all that separates them in the league, so it's pretty even footing so far. They've both come off a run of tough games.
I think Norwich, they've lost narrowly to Chelsea and drew with Arsenal. Yeah, drew with Arsenal. So the form's on their side. Watford, meanwhile, narrowly lost to United, courtesy of a Troy Deeney bundle into his net towards the end there. So it's a hard one to predict. I mean, worth considering is that the Canaries did win both meetings last season 3-0.
Now, a couple of other games, West Brom, Tottenham and Chelsea, Bournemouth. I'm really confident that Bournemouth could spring an upset here. It seems that as much as Chelsea take two steps forward, they take one step back every time. Diego Costa throwing his bib at Jose Mourinho on the weekend. All is not right. Has he lost the dressing room?
I don't know exactly if he has lost the dressing room, but it's beginning to seem that way. If you've complained like he had about Eden Hazard not being ideally suited to the number 10 role, and then he comes out against Spurs and sticks him up front and rests Diego Costa, who, for all we know, you know, was fully fit, ready to go, I think that tells you something about the state of affairs behind the doors there.
And Sunday night, Newcastle-Liverpool?
Yeah, Newcastle are terrible. I think that's all we can say about them. They're struggling all over the place at the minute. But Liverpool boss Jurgen Klopp's turned it around, and he had some interesting stuff to say about the rumours linking him with Jack Butland.
Absolutely satisfied with our goalkeeper situation. I'm sorry to kill your stories about goalkeepers and German goalkeepers and different goalkeepers from Stoke or wherever. We're not looking for another goalkeeper. Yeah. We have enough high-quality goalkeeper. Simon Mignolet, I had a lot of goalkeepers in the last few years, and he's one of the smartest I ever had. He's open, completely open. As is it possible that now it's louder with your tipping? Because it's an interesting thing to talk about. Cool down, guys.
Typical Klopp. He's very laid back, you know, man of the people. And I think it was interesting that he's ruled out, you know, any sort of interest, be that true or not, about Jack Butland. He's a very promising keeper, but from the reports that are coming out, you know, Klopp's impressed with Mignolet. He regards him as being very intelligent, and he's reportedly going to be offered a new deal. So a far cry from Mignolet's early days at the club. The other game of the weekend is Everton at Palace. Everton seem to be picking up momentum with each passing week. Gerard Deulofeu is, I think he's second in assists only in the league to Mesut Ozil, so that shows you the company he's keeping. And I think with Romelu Lukaku beginning to fire as well, I would expect them to beat Palace at home on Monday.
And you've got some news from Europe?
Oh yeah, just a bit of, you know, bit of brief news, I guess. So Real Madrid in the week actually fielded Denis Cheryshev in their Copa del Rey game. Turns out that he was actually eligible for that game due to picking up three bookings in his time at Villarreal last season on loan. So they're in a bit of hot water now, which is not really what Benitez would be hoping for, the way things are going for him at the minute. Now, looking at past indiscretions, Real should technically be excluded from the competition from here, and Cadiz, who they beat in the week, should be reinstated. Now, that actually happened last season with Osasuna. They made the same mistake. I think it was Unai Garcia that played, and they were knocked out of the competition. So it'll be interesting to see which rules get bent here for one of the league's bigger clubs. And the other news from Spain briefly that's come out, it's kind of been buried amongst the Gary Neville news being appointed at Valencia. There's been a new TV deal announced over there. Now, it's for €2.6 billion, which is a fair old wedge by anyone's standard, I think. But it represents a change from the previous direction where Real Barcelona could negotiate their own deals. So I think it's going to break down. Everybody gets a bit more money. It's filtered into the second division, which the chasm between first and second division clubs in Spain is huge. So it's a promising time for the game. And I think that's a good step moving forwards.
Certainly is.
Thanks, Ben. Great effort yet again, mate. It's been wonderful to listen to you, the analysis, that slightly deeper conversation that we're all really interested in, mate. Talk to you again next week.
Lovely. Thanks for having me.
Next up, Stoppage Time with Mark Van Aken.
Box to box.
Can you believe it?
The Chemist Warehouse.
Home of real brands and real savings.
And this could be the most crucial goal of all.
Mark Van Aken, the fourth official, signals there's 9 minutes on the board. What's on in Stoppage Time, mate?
Well, look, we're going to start it off semi-serious at least here. Gary Neville has been appointed coach of Valencia until the end of next season, just hours after his brother Phil was announced as the interim manager. Interesting to see if this is good, bad or otherwise for Matt Ryan, of course, the Socceroo custodian. One school of thought is, well, hey, they both speak English, sort of. So see how that goes. And also Jamie Carragher. Now, he's missing his old sparring partner now over there in the UK on Sky Sports.
Yeah, well, one of the top paid pundits, and look, the fans just love listening to ex-players, ex-coaches, managers that can dissect
especially
the game.
Especially ones they can't understand, like Jamie. Yeah, he's coming to Australia in Jan. Trying to get him on Box to Box.
No, but seriously, but has Neville left a little too early from the English coaching structure? How important is he to Roy Hodgson? They say he's going to stay, but how can you possibly manage a first division side in one of the top leagues in the world and give all of your attention to an international team that's going into one of the biggest tournaments in the world next year?
Ask Jus, I think. Ask Jus.
Okay.
Although we're not comparing apples with apples there, are we? So moving right along. Now, more stuff, more explosive stuff on this fan gate, some people are calling it. I don't like that because it's a bit cliched. But it came out yesterday on Fox Sports through the News Corp press. Ex-A-League boss and Wanderers CEO Lyle Gorman, who's now in the top job at NRL side Cronulla, says he was never fully comfortable with FFA's lack of an appeals process for suspended fans, but the Federation, in his words, considered itself bulletproof. I've read some quotes directly from Gorman. This is pretty explosive. So this is, of course, just people catching up. This is going back to what we're talking about off the top of the show, all the stuff that's gone on this week. And at the crux of it has been the CEO of FFA, David Gallop, going, and Damien DeBowen, the head of A-League, just playing a straight bat to everything, saying, no, 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 we're in charge, nothing to see here, go away. And it's been brewing for years. So anyway, back to Gorman's comments. That feeling has grown this year, but has certainly been festering for a few years now. And it certainly was while I was in the A-League, said Gorman. I will never condone antisocial behaviour in any environment. And it's important to say it for the 50th time, yet neither do we. But at the same time, my upbringing in life has always been about fairness and a due process as well. I often used to raise it internally, and the response was that we, as in the FFA, had an incredible faith in the process with the external agency, and that was incredibly bulletproof. The belief was there was no need to embrace a broader judicial process that would have been costly, requiring lots of resources and time-consuming, when they felt that investigation into the allegations were virtually bulletproof.
Well, that was clear as it could possibly be. And if that story gets legs in the media, then the story of the whole fan crisis becomes more and more embarrassing.
It's going to roll on.
Do you know, in all this media coverage and all the discussions and all the articles, Hatamoto, our friends at
Hatamoto, hail Hatamoto,
they have got off scot-free. They've got off scot-free. Well, and they are part of the problem, and I'm sure this review may...
For the uninitiated, Hatamoto.
Hatamoto are the security, basically the FFA security agency, engaged to monitor fans, but they're more than, they're not your warm old security. These guys are basically, am I right in saying, basically an intelligence organisation?
Correct.
So we're talking, you know,
they chase 16-year-olds around the streets of Sydney and Melbourne who go to the football.
Really?
Yeah, they do. That's what they
anyway,
do.
But that's been a bugbear of fans for a long time, Rob, that this is not your stock standard, you know, I'm just pulling these names that I could seeing in my mind off the back of jackets at Rugby League and Aussie Rules, but these are not your NSRs or whatever it might be. These are taking it to the next level, and there's probably, as this all unfolds, there's going to be some serious questions about the methods they use together. And look, we want to make this a lighter segment, so we will get to that in a sec, but just going back to David Gallop's comments at the presser yesterday, where he was talking about they can't put a clear, concise a tribunal in place, so to speak, because of they're relying on people sort of dobbing in unruly fans and supplying things in an anonymous fashion. I question, that's fantastic. Why can't that be done through a tribunal? Why can't you say, as the example I'd use, Rob, you broke a seat, you threw it at Kevin Muscat. I videotaped it because I thought that's a despicable act. I can go to the FFA and say, well, here's a guy. He's throwing a seat at Kevin Muscat. I think it's despicable. Should be banned for life. Bang, they've got the evidence. My name doesn't come up anywhere. Mm. And then when you get your banning order, you can say, well, can I see the evidence? And they'll say, yeah, here you go, Rob. Here's a video of you throwing it. Why can't we have that?
Yeah, Sebastian made that point earlier on in the program, talking about self-policing. That's something that if the fans are genuinely wanting to play a part in sorting this whole issue out,
clearly it's been happening. I mean, that's what David Gallop said. He said a lot of the evidence is gathered by other fans, which it is what it is. That's fine. But let people see it.
But I've got a question that hasn't been raised I haven't seen it anywhere. Who is the leak? How would you be feeling if you were the leak? Where is the leak? Where did it come from? Was it a club? Was it from the FFA? Was it from Hatamoto?
Are we talking about the 198 list?
Yeah, well, that's where it all started.
Clearly. I've got my... Should I say? Well, it's clearly not FFA at this point.
Okay, so if it wasn't the FFA, then it appears that it may have come from clubland. That's the suggestion then.
Oh, I don't think it's come from clubland. I think it's come from stadium land.
Okay.
Or police land.
Will we find out?
No. I think it's conjecture. Let's move on from that, Mark. Let's get into a bit of fun.
I've got a headache. Let's move on. Disgruntled Leeds United fans, let's talk about disgruntled fans in another country at least, have voiced their anger over plans to introduce a new pie tax.
I tell you what, you and I would be in all sorts of trouble.
Struggling. I'd happily pay a pie tax in Melbourne anyway, that's fine. Anyway, so they've warned the A-League Championship club that it risks losing the loyalty of the supporters. I would have thought 10 years of misery would do that with Leeds United, but anyway. Club officials are set to introduce an additional $10 charge starting this month in one of the stadium stands, with adult ticket prices rising to $85, including a meal voucher, regardless of whether fans want the pie or not. Surely a masterstroke from unpopular owner Massimo Cellino, given manager Stephen Evans looks like he's impartial to a pie or two. And how's it all work? Is this just a ploy to get around FIFA fair play regulations, boys? Does it come into it?
Yep.
Pie gate?
Yeah, I agree. It's another gate. It's like the lizard gate last week.
Okay. They got big issues at Leeds.
They have. They've got many issues, and now they're exacerbating it. I wonder what the pies are up. The Yorkshire pies would be great, though, wouldn't they?
Mate, they'd be better off getting Harry Kewell and the V-bomber back. Sort the place out.
We're going to get Harry Kewell on the show in a couple of weeks. Guaranteed. He's going to talk about his non-selection of Liverpool champions.
Yeah, he's not happy with that, Harry. Anyway. No. Now, this is absolute gold, lads. Mauritian President Mohamed Ould Abdel Aziz was in attendance for the Mauritian Super Cup final this week between FC Tervraag Zena, I'm sure I've pronounced that absolutely perfectly, and ACS Zar at the Stade Municipal, and everything was going fine, boys, until the second half, when in the 63rd minute, with the game locked at 1-1, a nail biter, the leader lost interest in the game and ordered the team straight into a penalty shootout. Now, I think it's fair to say football was the winner there, boys, was it not? Can we think of other events we'd just like to skip to the end of? Any match under Mourinho, I would have thought.
Formula One broadcast?
Yeah, Formula One. I'm probably going to annoy some listeners out there.
I'm not saying the next one on your notes. Oh. I dare you to.
We go on. We don't have a netball show on this network, do we?
Oh, that's low.
Mate,
you put netball on, I'll go skip right to the end. Hopefully, though,
mate,
Rob,
our World Cup winning Diamonds are one of the great teams of Australian sport.
Played in three countries,
and one of the great games of the finals in Australian sport this year was the Queensland Firebirds beating the New South Wales Swifts.
Thanks,
I was on the edge of my seat.
Rob, hang on, we've got a bit of North Korean news as well, which is always interesting.
Yeah, we have Kim Jong-un. Now, this is coming out of all sorts of media agencies. Has banned everyone in North Korea now has to have the same haircut as him.
What's the problem with
that? I'm not
making
this up.
He's a good-looking rooster.
It's a good haircut. It is actually quite a modern haircut. Mm. But no, apparently this is a serious story. You're not allowed to have hair in North Korea anymore, longer than 2 centimetres. And they've actually got, the Politburo basically out with, this can't be real, can it? This has actually been reported in real media. Anyway, that's enough. So next time we come up against the North Koreans, whether it's the Socceroos or Matildas, Rob, look out.
Kim Jong-il is just going fantastic. Look, what would you do if you
were
king, a dictator? Or Kim Jong-un, that's him. Well, that's why he's going fantastic, guys. So on that note, that has been Box to Box for another week on NTS News Talk Sport. Thanks to our very good mates at Chemist Warehouse. You're listening to us on digital radio, on the NTS app, and on TuneIn Radio. Box to Box for another week. The whistle goes. We'll see you in a week's time.